tear those mountains down.
You're listening to the Old Mole Variety Hour on KBOO Portland. I'm your host for today, Joe Clement, as well as your engineer. The Old Mole is a political magazine for the radio, a radio zine. We bring you interviews, commentary, reviews, music, readings, and other odds and ends radio magic. We all consider ourselves socialists or communists or unionists or anarchists or feminists or anti-imperialists or anti-racists, most of them all at once. We showcase the struggle for a world where we can live free from exploitation and domination and can live at peace with each other and with ourselves. Today's Old Mole starts off with Bill Resnick talking with fellow KBOO programmer John Shuck about progressive religion, about challenging the authoritarian tendency that humans bring to religion, and the lessons that people who practice religion and grow up in religious traditions have to bring to political movements that need to rouse people and foster relationship and help people heal themselves in a world that has taught them to hate each other and themselves. After that, Fran Michel reviews Jack London's 1908 novel, The Iron Heel, which has been re-released in the last 10 years. The Iron Heel tells a story from the future about how the United States fell into political disorder and was taken over by an oligarchic power structure known as the Iron Heel, which would reign for hundreds of years but be ultimately vanquished by a socialist revolution. Later in the show, Clayton Morgeridge considers what he calls the epidemic of despair. What is it about these times that gives rise to the increase in deaths of despair, like suicides, opioid overdoses, and even mass shootings? And to round out today's show, Movie Mole's Denise Morris and Jan Hawken review the new period piece called Detroit, which is about the 1967 Detroit Rebellion, which arose after police raided an unlicensed after-hours bar known as the Blind Pig just north of 12th Street and Virginia Park Avenue in Detroit. Denise and Jan will consider what this film has to say about black life and about black political movements and the sources of civil unrest, as it's called. You can listen to The Old Mole on KBOO's own website, kboo.fm/Old Mole Variety Hour. In a few days, we'll post the whole show as well as individual segments for you to download or share. You can follow us on Facebook or Twitter by searching for the Old Mole Variety Hour or email us at oldmolevarietyhour@gmail.com to learn about getting involved with the show or just to leave us a comment or ask us a question. We'll now turn to Bill Resnick and John Shuck to talk about religion and progressive values.
Hi, John Shuck. I can't say welcome to KBOO because you're always here.
That's right.
But I can say welcome to the Old Mole Variety Hour.
Well, it is an honor to be here.
Well, thank you, John. John Shuck is a board op here at KBOO Monday and Thursday early mornings. I see him recording and editing a lot as well. I knew he had a religious show here at KBOO, but must admit I never heard it. It's on progressive religion. Last night I opened his website, and I was absolutely amazed. In the old 60s phrase, I was blown away by its depth and breadth and its, especially its implications. Radical critiques of the way this country is going, radical critiques of most establishment religion, although generous to some extent, it seems to me, radical critiques of establishment morality. And it seems to me you're really proposing a radically different morality as to values, as to practices, as to sexuality and work and authority, relations to one another, relations to nature. It's a glimpse for me of what had to be, because most of these people were affiliated with churches, and there are all kinds of stations that were running your interviews. And there are all these people organized in churches and practicing their religion on a daily basis. This is by far the biggest left in the United States that one could imagine, is my sense.
The religious left,
the religious left. Why not just be a political group, though, or a political party with this platform of support for the poor and good work for everybody, military disarmament, respect for nature and our fellow humans, police reform, reproductive rights. Black lives are the most endangered, and they matter. And also a sort of sense of participatory democracy versus hierarchical systems that we have in almost all institutions. Why not just be a political party advocating that rather than this disperse religious movement?
Why bring religion into it, in a sense?
Yeah, right.
Yeah, I was first asked to do this show when I was in Tennessee, East Tennessee. That's where I lived before I lived here. And you can turn on the radio and you will find constant religious programming. And it's always very much connected with right-wing politics. And so I was asked actually by at a college radio station because I had another blog, Shuck and Jive, in which I wrote a lot of this kind of stuff. And the general manager asked me to do a show about this because you wanted an alternative religious voice because so much of the right-wing politics had the religious language connected to it. So it isn't necessarily just a response, but it's part that. I also happen to be connected with, you know, with a religious tradition. I grew up in it, although it was fundamentalist. I've also found that within it, there is a strong critique of empire, of abuse, of violence, of all of these kinds of things that have often not been necessarily lifted up within religion, because usually people use religion to do bad things, frankly. I mean, we can think about that. But yeah, there's also a use of religion that can inspire sublime madness of the soul, as Reinhold Niebuhr would say. Chris Hedges quoted him when he was speaking here, and I thought that was great. You kind of need that sense of a religious, spiritual identity, something bigger than yourself, whatever that might be, to carry the movement forward.
I guess also to do it together and to have it influence your life and to see yourself with others with these same beliefs. But there's also a sort of sense of faith. People need meaning and purpose. They just don't need political goals or anger at authoritarians. They need to feel as part of something larger and yet creating it themselves with others.
Yes.
And singing it too, and dancing it, and celebrating life.
Absolutely.
You know, I go to too many left meetings where nobody's celebrating life. We may even end singing Solidarity Forever, although we often don't. I used to love to sing the International at the end of meetings.
Sure. And one of the things that communities have is that that's one of the few places where you actually can sing together or do things together or talk about meaningful things. Even, for example, my friends who are atheists, I consider myself a Christian atheist, which is marvelously jarring. But my friends who say, you know, and then now there are all these atheist kind of churches. There's the need for the very thing that you're talking about. And so my thing is, well, I'm already in this institution. It's already got a lot of property. It's already got all the time. It's got history and tradition. Why hand it over to the most obnoxious of people? Let's reclaim it and find the value in it and use it to do good.
This is KBOO Radio, and we have two KBOO hosts on the air. I'm Bill Resnick for The Old Mole. I'm talking to John Shuck, who does the show Progressive Spirit. When are you on, John? It's not a time when I'm ever listening.
Progressive Spirit is a podcast. It's a weekly podcast. The show that is on, and that it's occasionally on KBOO, but there's a similar show called The Beloved Community. It's the second Friday at 9 a.m. So that's mostly local Portland, but it's the same issues.
But you're all over the country.
On the Progressive Spirit one, that's an hour-long show. It's on about 10 stations, mostly through Pacifica, some college stations, because it connects me with the things I need.
It must be very fulfilling for you, but it also connects you with a lot of people.
Yeah, I always have material for sermons.
And you have terrific people to quote and to emulate and to kind of raise ideas in interesting ways.
You know, yeah, because there are a lot of people with a lot of things to say, and it's difficult within the media to talk about issues of social justice and spirituality or religion or whatever you want to call it, because most religious radio, as you know, is basically the right-wing fundamentalist stuff, and you don't get a lot of that on the other side, and so it's...
But there is a lot of it on the other side.
There's a movement that just isn't publicized often.
It's sort of hiding in plain sight, actually. People publish books, they have churches, they do sermons, they do conferences, and there's so many branches of it. It's decentralized. It's radically decentralized all over this country, right? Little churches. You're the head minister of a little church in what, Beaverton?
Beaverton, yeah. Beaverton. Southminster is the church. Southminster Presbyterian.
Oh, and that's your full-time job that...
That's the full-time job that pays.
That pays. when you do a wedding, though, you get an extra emolument.
You know, that's an amazing thing. I don't do very many weddings. People don't need ministers to do them anymore, which is a good thing. They go out and get married in the woods or whatever and have somebody who gets an online degree. And I think that's a wise thing to separate that from church. But that's a different issue altogether.
It's a wise thing. It's also good to have people who help develop the discourse. Sometimes you go to these homemade weddings, and the discourse is only, I love you, rather than we are together in this great, we're becoming a different kind of unit within this great struggle.
Well, I'm glad you mentioned that there is a sense of loss of some quality of those. No,
it's good. I think it's a very good homemade everything.
Homemade is good.
Homemade of everything is good, except for violence. Yes,
that's right.
There's some of that too. Well, and the worst kind of violence, all sorts of it, that gets centered in the happy home. But that's another matter that the church deals with, actually, it seems to me, in lots
of ways.
You
know, I want to just send you, I want to give one more question to that first question about why religion. And it happened because I was at the masjid, the mosque, and it was Anila Afzila, I believe is her name, a Muslim woman. And what she was doing was talking about Islam from a feminist perspective. So you find people recovering the traditions that they have to use them in liberating ways today. That is a thing that's also happening. People are looking back to their old traditions and realizing, wait a second, this Muhammad was a really radical guy for his time, and Jesus or whoever. And so they're finding that again and finding, hey, wait a second, there's some parallels going on here. I can use this and connect with it that way.
Well, that's a question I wanted to ask you about, and it has to do with theism and monotheism and the creation of a God and then giving the God these human capacities to punish you or to reward you and to lead you, and then the sense that God gave you the commandments and we have to enforce those commandments, and those commandments are, some of them are okay, love your neighbor, some of them are quite terrible, and the right wing, of course, picks up the worst of it. Let's talk about, though, the kinds of, let's say, authority relations. I call them authority relations, but they're human relations. How people should live together, how decisions are made in families and in larger bodies. Religion is always, I mean, in many ways, the Pope, of course, is a central hierarch. His pronouncements from cathedra are infallible, of course. But most religion, in fact, have, and the people on top, of course, become bureaucrats who really want to run these things for what they see as universal purposes, which are often their own purposes, of course. The radical church, it seems to me, has to be organized differently and has to always struggle against the sort of hierarchy that a lot of people feel comfortable in. They often want to have somebody strong helping them through their difficulties. How do you deal with that?
Some have suggested that was part of Trump's appeal, this authoritarianism, and that people needed that. And that's certainly true for religion, especially as it's reinforced. The Pope wasn't infallible until the 19th century. It was really a response to modern criticism that these doctrines came back in, that suddenly he is the guy. And that's what happened. That's biblical fundamentalism didn't start until the 19th century as a response to modern criticism of the Bible and evolutionary theory. And so we think Christian religion, it wasn't always this distorted, and especially it came back again, especially with the rise in the 80s with Reagan and the moral majority and all of that kind of stuff. So now the mainstream Christian religion in the United States is a fundamentalism. That wasn't the case, you know, earlier decades.
It seems to me it was way before the 19th century, though, that the consolidation of a hierarchy. For example,
true.
In the medieval period, there were heresies, radically democratic places where the church became part of a very democratic society of small artisans and all the rest of it, and caring for one another independent of central authority, whether king or church. And of course, in that period, those heresies like the Anabaptists, and there were many, many heresies where people got together to form really democratic societies, they were wiped out and tortured to death.
Oh, yeah.
It's
brutal.
The hierarchy of the church in the Inquisition, like in the Catholic Church, it was absolutely brutal and efficient of wiping out whole societies. So, I mean, it's a lengthier process, but
it is.
Of course, the Romans wiped out, hierarchs always grow and kill democracy. I mean, real radical democracy.
Yeah, when the Roman Empire became the Holy Roman Empire, when the church was ultimately wedded with Constantine, that started a different path all along. And that's exactly right with the authoritarianism. And that's why the wonderful groups such as the monasteries and nuns were such a threat to often the authoritarian aspect of it.
Oh, right. They then would rebel in lots of ways. The church was always sort of, but they, of course, needed the labor of these people.
Yep. That's right.
So you had this, well, you did have slave labor. I mean, that's another facet of it, of course.
But your question, I think, is authoritarian. And I think that spirituality or religion, what I try to teach people is that you have permission. You know, you already, and it isn't anybody, nobody grants it, that of freedom of thought and freedom to exercise your values and to read texts in ways that are liberating to you and not necessarily connected with an authoritative interpretation. And so,
This is KBOO Radio. Bill Resnick here interviewing John Shuck, who does the show Progressive Spirit on KBOO. And he does a blog and he does interviews that are played by small stations all over the country, and they're available to all. He actually is building a large audience, not just in Portland. And John's a board op at KBOO. Why do you come in at 6 in the morning on Mondays and Thursdays?
Mondays and Thursdays, my volunteer work. And I'm actually on a board of KBOO, too.
Oh, you're on the board. I didn't know that. Well, there you go. Oh, John, you really do have two jobs. Anyway.
You mentioned Christian atheism. I'll say a quick thing about that I think is very helpful. God or gods was something, that's how the world worked when you think of before in modern science. Well, now modern science doesn't really, we don't need gods to do the work anymore. So that doesn't mean necessarily that religion's out of place, because religion always was, which god? Is it our God or this God? Is it the God of, let's say, Caesar, or the God of perhaps we might say Jesus or Muhammad, who, you know, was about social justice? So that was always the question. It wasn't necessarily where God exists. It's what kind of God. And now we don't need gods, but we still have that question of how we value and how we're going to structure society and how we're going to structure human values. And that's why Christian atheism, I think, is the modern way and way to go.
Yeah.
Way to go.
Yeah. I always thought sort of the radical position for the church was God is not some anthropomorphized sort of person, you know, who gives the laws and who's somehow and administers punishment and rewards for those those who obey his commandments, which are often very restrictive and terrible, depending on who interprets them, of course, the human interpreter. Then there are some groups that say, well, but God is a spirit. God is an ethical sort of – God is sort of the life force that binds us all together. I mean, that's sort of a middle position that I always thought, that's all right, you mm-hmm. know. But a lot of your guests want to dispense with this whole idea that there is some set of ideals and values that come before human process and before humans. A lot of your guests seem to be saying, and so they see themselves as atheists rather than agnostics even, but atheists that are, and it's a principled position. I see that your guys are, I mean, women too, mostly women, actually, it seems to me you've interviewed over the years, actually.
Well, Greta Vosper is the United Church of Canada minister who lost her position, viewed unsuitable. It's the most liberal denomination probably on the face of the planet. But she came out as atheist, basically in solidarity with atheists who have been killed in Bangladesh. Uh-huh. But she said, this is what we all learned, and she's right. I learned the exact same thing, that there is no anthropomorphic God. And yet when we use that language, people in the church think we're talking about that. And so she wanted to say honestly what it is. Well, yes, God is a human creation, like a religion is a human creation and all of that kind of things.
That we make our own values.
Yeah,
you're saying in life we have to make decisions about how we want to live. We don't look to some kind of predetermined
supernatural
deity, sort of force that we have to look to. I mean, of course, it's a little frightening, and it's easier to say, well, this is sort of natural and the way that humans should live, and it's given to us somehow out of some kind of essential thing. You're saying we make our lives and we have to make decisions about our lives and we have to live together according to them, which is a more challenging.
It's a more challenging thing, and then it's up to you to find out what is valuable and good and be able to share that publicly and be critiqued about it too.
I wish we had then time to talk about that though within a church, and what do people who want to live by those values, how do you make them real and, quote, institutionalize, that sociological word? How do you build practices that, in fact, give people the capacity and power to live that way? But we're not going to be able to talk about that now, but maybe another time.
Oh, I'd love to come back and talk about it, sure.
Yeah, I mean, how do we live that way in a world where the rewards come and security comes from acting very, very differently? You've got to accumulate a fortune to be able to be secure in this country now. And a lot of people spend a lot of time. It's not just love of money. It's the deep desire not to be vulnerable.
Yeah.
And I mean, for most people, they're very afraid of being vulnerable. They don't want to be rich. And then possessions sort of are a sign of that security. It's a very complex process, the way in which capitalism, I say, sort of demoralizes people. That's for another time. Anyway, let's talk about all of those things again. Thank you very much. John Chuck, who's a KBOO on the board and does interviews here and broadcasts them all over the world. Thanks a lot for talking to us.
Thank you. It's a pleasure.
There's a light that was shining when the world began. There's a light that is shining in the heart of a man. There's a light that is shining, friend, in me and in you. So let your light shine in all that you do. Walk in the light wherever you may be. Walk in the light wherever you may be. In my old leather breeches and my shaggy, shaggy locks, I am walking in the glory of the light, said Fox. With a book and a steeple and a bell and a key, they would bind it forever, but they can't, said he. Oh, the book, it will perish and the steeple will fall, but the light will be shining at the end of it all. Walk in the light wherever you may be. Walk in the light wherever you may be. In my old leather breeches and my shaggy, shaggy locks, I am walking in the glory of the light, said Fox.
If we give you a pistol, will you fight for the Lord?
But you can't kill the devil with a gun or a sword.
Will you swear on the Bible?
I will not,
said he, for the truth is more holy than the book to me.
You're listening to KBOO Portland. I'm Joe Clement, your host for the Old Mole Variety Hour. That was George Fox, sung by the band Bicycle Face, song originally written by Sidney Carter. Before that, we heard Bill Resnick talking with John Chuck about the progressive and pro-social values that have long accompanied the practice of religion, as well as a frank discussion of how religion has facilitated the exact opposite. Up next, Fran Michel reviews a redemption story of sorts, Jack London's 1908 novel, The Iron Heel.
After last November's election, magazines and websites offered any number of articles and listicles with titles like Dystopian Novels That May Soon Become Reality in Trump's America and 20 essential books to prepare you for what's next, and dystopian books Trump wouldn't want you to read. The earliest work to appear on most of these lists, and a work often described as the earliest of dystopian novels, is The Iron Heel by Jack London, published in 1908. Probably London's fullest fictional presentation of his socialist views, it's a book that Leon Trotsky, some 30 years later, called a prophetic vision of fascism, of its economy, of its governmental technique, its political psychology. Jack London foresaw and described the fascist regime as the inevitable result of the defeat of the proletarian revolution. End quote. The book has its flaws, as Trotsky acknowledged, though I would include that sense of inevitability as one of them. Still, it's a compelling depiction of the workings of capitalism. The middle-class female narrator speaks in the sentimental rhetoric of melodrama, a kind of appeal that has historically proven effective in moving Americans on political issues, most famously in Harriet Beecher Stowe's anti-slavery novel Uncle Tom's Cabin. But Avis Everhard focuses her narrative on a working-class hero devoted to the rational appeal to material fact. When Avis Cunningham meets Ernest Everhard, he tells her that her dress is stained with blood, and then goes on to introduce her to the bleeding workers whose unrecompensed injuries, as well as their more figurative lifeblood, has gone to swell the stock dividends that have paid for Avis's dress. The injuries are unrecompensed because, although the workers can sue for damages, the other workers won't risk their own jobs by honest testimony, reporters, no editors won't publish stories unfriendly to their advertisers and investors, and the judge and the corporate lawyer belong to the same club. The need to feed their children keeps workers bound to the industrial machine by their heartstrings, but some are bound so that they're on top of the machine, and the aristocratic class believes that they are in the right. They believe this despite having no good explanation for the miseries of capitalism. When Ernest challenges a group of oligarchs to defend capitalism's bad management of a world with both massive productive forces and massive poverty, he gets no satisfactory answer other than the response that will ultimately come in the form of a bullet. The socialists do first win at the ballot, back in the days before widespread purging of voter rolls and electronic voting machines. But they're framed for a bombing, and the whole socialist congressional delegation is arrested. So the revolutionists move underground, spying on the oligarchs as they are spied upon. The second half of the novel, once Avis Everhard's political education is complete, her marriage consummated figuratively as well as literally, consists in the story of a failed revolt against the machine. The blood of the workers become literal blood in the streets. One might read the failure of that revolt as a result of its vanguardist strategies. The revolutionists want to save and to manipulate those they call the people of the abyss, the labor serfs or lumpen proletariat. But they do not identify themselves with those workers or include them as agents of the revolution. Yet the fascist dystopia of the Iron Heel is wrapped inside a socialist utopia. The manuscript, Avis writes, has been published some 700 years after her death and features a foreword and footnotes written in the year 419 of the Brotherhood of Man. It's not surprising that the future socialist utopia is called the Brotherhood of Man, since despite the presence of Avis and other women in the ranks of the revolutionaries, the book doesn't register the possibility of women's emancipation, nor the possibility that there might be anything other than the class system from which to be liberated. And as some readers have noted, it's probably just as well, given London's record on questions of race, that there's little about that in the book, though it is very strange to think of a socialist revolution in the U.S. that doesn't have something to do with race. London's social Darwinist leanings emerge in the novel through Ernest Everhard's Übermensch qualities and help explain the book's sometime popularity with readers on the right. But that weird convergence of left and right resonates today with the fascist creep against which we do well to be alert. Moreover, for leftish readers today, The Iron Heel offers not only a sharp diagnosis of capitalism, but also a salutary reminder of the struggles of the past and how close the possibility of socialist change has sometimes seemed in the U.S. As Naomi Klein has reminded us, we haven't lacked for ideas. Universal health care, living wages, cooperatives, participatory democracy, public services that are accountable to the people who use them, food, medicine, shelter as a human right. These aren't new ideas. They're enshrined in the UN Charter. Nor have we lacked resources. Apple Incorporated has a market capitalization of close to $600 billion. That's billion with a B. And ExxonMobil is on target to make about $100 billion in gross profit this year. As Klein observes, we can tax the polluters and the casino capitalists to pay for alternative energy development and a global social safety net. Nor is the problem political will or coordination among political leaders. In The Iron Heel, the character who most believes that the problem is simple ignorance is a clergyman who is shocked to learn, under Ernest's tutelage, the extent of the suffering of the poor. But his wealthy congregation is shocked at the turn his sermons then take, and he ultimately loses his job, his home, and his freedom when he's declared insane and committed. As Klein says, quote, "Elites don't make justice because we ask them nicely and appealingly. They do it when the alternative to justice is worse. And that's what happened all those years ago when the income gap began to close. That was the motivation behind the New Deal and the Marshall Plan. Communism spreading around the world, that was the fear. Capitalism needed to soften its edges." Klein notes of these alternatives to the so-called free market, they were chosen, and then they were stolen. They were stolen by military coups. They were stolen by massacres. They were stolen by trickery, by deception. They were stolen by terror. These blueprints for another world were crushed and disappeared because they are popular and because, when tried, they work. They're popular because they have the power to give millions of people lives with dignity, with the basics guaranteed. They are dangerous because they put real limits on the rich, who respond accordingly. As Frederick Douglass knew, power concedes nothing without a demand. It never did, and it never will. For the Old Mall Variety Hour, this has been Fran Michel.
This next song was written by another Irish poet by the name of Jim Connell. This song was actually written in 1896, and had already become very popular among the workers of the United Kingdom, Ireland, and the United States. The only difficulty we had when we began to learn to sing it, because we thought we had to learn this song, it's a great anthem, was that for the Swiss contingent, it was a little bit difficult to sing with any seriousness a militant labor song to the tune of O Tannenbaum. So we decided that in order to give it the proper feeling and retain the melody, we had to go to Detroit and get some Motown. Ready?
Traitors near, we will keep the red.
That was the James Connolly Songs of Freedom Band singing The Red Flag, which was a popular song at the time that Jack London wrote his novel The Iron Heel, which Fran Michel was reviewing before that. We'll head back to Detroit later in the show when Movie Mole's Jan Hawken and Denise Morris review the film called Detroit. Up next, Clayton Morgeridge offers his thoughts on epidemics of despair and what we can do to respond to them.
There is an epidemic of despair in the United States. The visible part is the increase in what have been called deaths of despair, deaths by drugs, alcohol, and suicide. Among people who have not gone to college and for whom a traditional middle-class life is more and more out of reach, such deaths are rising steadily. The increases are connected to a measurable deterioration in economic and social well-being. In a West Virginia town where textile plants and woolen mills that once provided good jobs now stand empty, a journalist who used to live there was asked why so many people there are struggling with opioids, including heroin. He responded, "In my opinion, the desperation in this area and places like it is a social vacancy," he said. "People don't feel they have a purpose. Many drug addicts trying to escape the reality that this place doesn't give them anything. That's really hard to live with when you look around and see that 7 out of 10 of your friends from high school are still here and nobody makes more than $36,000 a year and everybody's just bitching about bills and watching these crazy shows on reality TV and not doing anything," unquote. A professor at West Virginia University who studies drug addictions described opioids as the ultimate escape drugs. She said, "Boredom and a sense of uselessness and inadequacy, these are human failings that lead you to just want to withdraw. On heroin, you curl up in a corner and blank out the world. It's an extremely seductive drug for dead-end towns because it makes the world's problems go away." End of quote. "Feeling hopeless about climate change? Well," said someone recently on Facebook, "there's an app for that, oxycodone." When economic opportunity becomes a desert and people's desires are thwarted at every turn, they lose hope. No sense of purpose, no reason to get out of bed in the morning. That's the state of despair. I want to be something, to do something, but I don't know what. I want to matter in the world, but I have no idea how. I'm full of desire, full of the vitality of a living being, but my desire is a curse because I don't know where to go with it, what to aim it at. Opioids solve that problem. I no longer despair at having nothing to do because I simply don't care. It no longer matters that I have nothing to do with my desire, because my desire, my vitality, is asphyxiated to where I hardly notice it, except for the one clear desire for the next pill, fix, or drink. Crushing one's desire moves one close to death, and many people fall off the edge, a risk they are willing to take because nothing, including life itself, matters anymore. But sometimes despair seeks other avenues of relief. Instead of smothering the desire for a life that means something, a person may force his life to mean something by an act of violence that takes revenge on the world that has given him no place to exist. This is one way of understanding those lonely men and boys who open fire on crowds and then turn their guns on themselves or allow the police to kill them. These are deaths of despair that cause yet more death. At a buried emotional level, such killers are taking revenge on a world that refused to recognize them. So we have an epidemic of despair leading to self-annihilation by opioids and to the enraged killer who takes his resentment out on others. Despair in a world with no place for hope, for a meaningful life. But what is it about our world that leaves so many people without hope? Well, what is required of a society if it is to be a medium in which human desire and achievement can flourish? It is not enough that people be fed and sheltered. There must be places in society in which people can feel that they matter, in which their existence and their activity are recognized. and the basic institutions of the society need to provide pathways to those positions, not obstacles. The deaths of despair we talked about stem from lack of ways to matter and to join with others in common projects. Capitalism is a form of society that at the best of times provides for some people some of these conditions for a good life. When it is expanding, there are jobs and entrepreneurial opportunities. However, even then, there are many losers, the unemployed, the homeless, and the indebted. And capitalist society is unstable. The regular occurrence of crises, depressions, and recessions is built into the system. Moreover, capital always goes where opportunities for profitable investment are greatest, which means it is always moving from one place or one form of activity to another, leaving behind communities and workers who are now of no use to capital, as happened in the Rust Belt in the 60s and 70s. And finally, even when capitalism is flourishing, it tends to reduce human desire to the desire for money and turn all value, including the value of our lives, into market value. Artistic activity, land and water, forests, and even our own labor become nothing more than raw material for capitalist exploitation. Now that's capitalism at the best of times. However, these are not the best of times. Capital is increasingly invested in complicated financial schemes that produce nothing besides inflated profits for wealthy investors and very few working-class jobs. Computerized production and distribution systems have de-skilled or eliminated many jobs. The result is too many people for whom capital has no use, leaving them with nothing much to do and too much time to do it in. The capitalist state steps in to control these extra people by mass entertainment, mass distribution of debilitating pharmaceuticals, and mass incarceration. So in a world where our lives depend on how and whether capital can be profitably invested, the best case scenario is one in which a good and meaningful life is shaped around the pursuit of money and what money can buy. In the worst-case scenarios, like the one we are living now, life loses meaning and despair sets in, despair that is either medicated into numbness and often death, or is transformed into rage that produces not only the spectacular sprees of violence that appear in the news, but innumerable acts of emotional and physical brutality behind closed doors. There is an alternative to living a life whose meaning is determined entirely by the stormy tides of capital, and that is to work in cooperation with others for a world order that honors and works to fulfill the full range of human need and desire. I'm Clayton Morgridge for the Old Mole Variety Hour.
And I'm Joe Clement, your host for the Old Mole Variety Hour. Up next, we turn to Denise Morris and Jan Hawken, our movie moles, are going to be talking about the new movie period piece called Detroit.
Thank you, Joe. This is Denise Morris and Jan Hawken. We both did see Detroit, and to say that the film is swirling with controversy would be an understatement, and we're going to try to unpack some of that and give our own reactions and thoughts about this film. The film is directed by Kathryn Bigelow. You may know her from such films as Hurt Locker and Zero Dark Thirty. And it was also written by Mark Boal. They've been a team for quite a while. Detroit is a fictionalized account of the violent interrogation of a group of residents and visitors who are staying in the Algiers Motel in Detroit in the context of the July 1967 Detroit uprisings. The film stars John Boyega as Melvin Demukes, who is the pragmatist, and he works two jobs. We also have Algie Smith as the lead singer of the R&B group The Dramatics, and he is our dreamer in the film. And we have also Will Poulter as the sadistic cop. We seem to have kind of iconic character elements here. The film opens with the raid of an unlicensed club during a celebration for the veterans returning from Vietnam. The raid is not the first by a long shot, and it becomes the spark, quote unquote, that ignites and propels people into the city streets to say basically we've had enough, and there's all violence, there's rioting, there's well, that's what we see in the film, and we're here to talk about the larger context, a little bit about what we don't see in the film, but some important notes about what it means to try to portray something as volatile and as controversial as what we call a riot in America. But Jan, you're more familiar with Bigelow's work, and you have a very concise way of understanding what she does. So let's start with that, because there is a lot of questioning and controversy around her right as a white filmmaker to even make this film.
She's known for her biggest commercial successes were The Hurt Locker and Zero Dark Thirty. Both of the films are about men in situations where they're authorized by the state to exercise lethal violence, and they become increasingly sadistic and unhinged by this authorized violence on the kind of front lines of the state. And her earlier films have been seen as moving too close to the intimacy of these encounters and the madness and sadism of them. Zero Dark Thirty was criticized, including by us here on the Old Mole, for basically it seemed ultimately like she was an apologist for torture and the CIA's use of torture. That was a very big problem with that film. But she's really good at getting close to just the palpable, sweaty anxiety of people in situations where they're trying to subdue a force, and they're authorized by the state to do this and become increasingly caught in the sadism of it. Now, in this context, she works with what she does well. In some ways, you could see this focus on the Algiers moving from the broad, the migration north, this little animated sequence at the very beginning, to the rebellion on the streets, to this claustrophobic scene of the Algiers Motel and the sadism that unfolds in these small rooms. It's kind of her ideal stage. But then the question is that the best way of framing this situation? Does she move too close in and stay too close to the police? Is there too much left on outside of that frame? And I think both the strength of the film also is part of what makes it so controversial and evokes so much. It's very disturbing to watch, and people have understandably different reactions. Does she have the right to do this kind of film, to have that kind of violence against the bodies of black people, black men? You know, when you do a film that's so close to history and intercut, there are devices that make it in the tradition of docudrama, intercut with news footage, so you feel like it's the real thing. And the responsibilities of a filmmaker go up quite a bit when you use those devices. And when you're talking about things that really happen to people and evoke understandably intense reactions.
And you know, you argue, of course, that in the end, there is a moral condemnation of this behavior, not so much on a systemic level, or maybe perhaps not at all on a systemic level, more like in that intimacy, in that individualized sense. And, you know,
her sympathies are partly with the front line of the state that's expected to both, you know, this cop, the sadistic cop, is clearly given mixed messages. You're not supposed to shoot looters in the back. Not mm-hmm. any. He kills someone who's looting a store, and then he's sent right out the next day.
Right, and he's facing criminal charges, but he goes back on the street.
Right, so yeah. It's clear that there's official line, you're not supposed to shoot people for stealing groceries, but on the other hand, they are supposed to quell a rebellion.
Right.
And so your sympathies are with these frontline police, but then it turns mm-hmm. and I think had to, or it would be an unforgivable film.
Right, yeah, and many people think it's unforgivable as it is. So, but there is this question about, you know, is this spectacle, is there something being captured here that has something to say, or is there nothing to say? And for me, one of the things that I think about often in these situations is, how does it work to appeal to this gut reaction, this emotional reaction to this kind of violence and visual horror? For me, I'm not so certain, based on all sorts of other understandings about how this works, that appealing on that level actually changes hearts and minds. And that's perhaps what the intent is in many of her films, but somehow she always seems to walk too fine a line, or, you know?
Yeah, and I'm always interested as a psychoanalytic film person, you know, what are the containing devices of the film? How does the film allow you to watch something that is pretty horrifying and anxiety-provoking? And then how does it help you with whatever anxieties are stirred up? And at the end, we have we have Motown music kind of intercut, which is also has a kind of distance, and it's reassuring, very sensual. It's not like hip-hop. It doesn't have that cutting edge of rage. It's a very reassuring sound. And so she uses that and the aspirations of these singers. It's both that part of the history of Motown, which is important, but it also gives you distance from just the palpable violence and rage. And then at the end, you have one of the performers retreating to the church and retreating to singing gospel songs. And that, well, it's true. I mean, on the one hand, the church is a place of sanctuary, political sanctuary in Black communities, but it also kind of contains the problem for the audience at the end, because it's, in that sense, I'm kind of suspicious of how that scene is used.
I agree, and I think part of the problem in having less context and less broad analysis or a more broad look at what was happening in the streets, we are left to think that we can contain this, what seems uncivilized behavior, in the framework of what a riot is understood to be versus what a rebellion might involve, which is community organizing, movement building, demands. And in fact, one reviewer pointed out that the only reason why there was a trial had to do with community organizing that had happened, and it did involve the church. It was the gathering place for people to come together and say, we as a community demand that you investigate and bring to trial these officers for their behavior. That's not in the films. So what it is that's being contained, it's not fleshed out, because
also the politics of the church.
Right. In the large, yeah, it retreats from the politics of the church versus perhaps the politics of Black liberation movements that were in full force at this point and growing. And
also Detroit was one of dozens of urban uprisings during that same summer. In the summer of 67, Detroit burned, but Milwaukee, Buffalo, Cincinnati, and Newark were also cities with massive urban rebellions. There was the Watts Uprising in 1965. It's still a question that's debated, whether not only what to call it, but what to call it, whether it's a riot or an uprising, revolt, rebellion. Those terms also suggest something about its rationality as a political strategy, and that question still hasn't been settled. Most of the people who were killed were Black men, Black people, primarily Black men, by the police.
And thousands arrested.
Yeah, there were 43 people killed during those days. 33 of them were Black people. So it's easy to focus on someone breaking into a store and stealing a TV rather than the number of people killed by the police. So there's always that collapsing of violence against property versus violence against people.
Right. And for two interesting thoughts about riot. We have Martin Luther King, who framed rioting as the language of the unheard, and others as the language of the youth. But also Bob Marley, who in his song Burning and Eluding, one of the lyrics is burning an illusion tonight. And I also think one last point is that, you know, in this good cop, bad cop thing that she does in the film, for me, begs the question of whether or not we want to understand as the system as being broken or functioning exactly as it's intended, which is as a racist institution. And that is what policing is. So it's not a question of good cops, bad cops, which we see a lot played out in the film.
Yeah, although I think it's clear, too, that other the National Guard, the police, politicians are implicated. But
right, exactly.
Yeah, we focus in on the one sadistic cop.
Yeah. But. Well, this is Denise Morris and Jan Hocken. We're talking about the film Detroit, directed by Catherine Bigelow, and its many controversies.
But it's a reason to read more about that history, and there are a couple museums that open this weekend, museum exhibits on the Detroit uprising.
Absolutely. Thank you.
Mother, mother, there's too many of you to cry. Brother, 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 there's far too many of you die. You know we've got to find a way to bring some love. Don't need to escalate. You see, war is not the answer, for only love can conquer hate. You know we've got to find a way to bring some love and get here today. Picket lines and picket signs. Punish me, sister, with brutality. Sister, talk to me, sister, so you can see. Sister, oh, what's going on?
What's going on?
What's going on?
What's going on?
Yeah, what's going on?
What's going on?
Oh, what's going on? What's
going on? Well, that's all the time we have for today's Old Mole Variety Hour. Thanks to Denise Morris and Jan Hocken for their review of Detroit. Thanks to Fran Michelle for her review of The Iron Heel. Thanks to Clayton for offering his thoughts on epidemics of despair, and thanks to Bill Resnick and John Shuck for talking about progressive religion. You can listen to any segment or the whole show in a couple or a few days by going to kboo.fm/Old Mole Variety Hour. For the Old Mole Variety Hour and KBOO Portland, I am Joe Clement.
They judge us simply 'cause our hair is long.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of the Montevilla Jazz Festival, Saturday, August 19th and Sunday, August 20th at Portland Metro Arts in Portland. The Montevilla Jazz Festival is a two-day festival that showcases the very best in original Portland jazz. The 2017 festival will host 12 performances over 2 days, featuring the Blue Cranes, Rebecca Kilgore, and is headlined by Portland's own Essiet Essiet. Again, that's the Montevilla Jazz Festival, Saturday, August 19th, and Sunday, August 20th at Portland Metro Arts, 9003 Southeast Stark Street in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
KBOO Community Radio.